You're with The Philosopher's Zone. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Sadly, Alan Saunders passed away on June the 15th. To celebrate the major contribution he made to the discussion of ideas, we continue his Philosopher's Zone series on Greek thinkers, which was first broadcast in November 2009. So here's Alan Saunders with the third program in the series, which focuses on Aristotle.
We've looked at the Hellenistic schools, the philosophers who came after Aristotle, and how their thought was carried into the Roman world. Today we're turning to the work of Aristotle himself and what happened to it. Physics, metaphysics, poetry, theatre, music, logic, rhetoric, politics, ethics, biology and zoology. There were few areas of thought that Aristotle didn't touch on, and he laid down principles that were to last for more than 1,000 years. Like Alexander the Great, Aristotle came from Macedonia. He was born there in 384 BC, and at around the age of 17, he was sent to Athens to study in Plato's Academy, then a preeminent place of learning in the Greek world. In 343, King Philip of Macedon invited him to become tutor to his 13-year-old son, Alexander. It didn't last long. By the age of 15, the young lad was already a deputy military commander, but it's difficult not to think that the association must have meant something to at least one of them. Aristotle returned to Athens in 335 and set up his own school in a public exercise area dedicated to the god Apollo Lykaios, whence its name, the Lyceum. The members of the school became known as Peripatetics, probably after the peripatos, the covered walkway on the school's property. He was settled here for 13 years. His wife died and he began a relationship with a woman who might have been his slave or who might have become his wife. We're not sure. What we do know is that after the death of Alexander, anti-Macedonian sentiments began to be revived in Athens. Would the Athenians, the men who a generation before had put Socrates to death, do the same to Aristotle? They didn't get a chance. Aristotle was out of there, remarking before he went that he wouldn't let them make the same mistake twice. The following year, 322, he died of natural causes on the island of Euboea. To talk about Aristotle and his heritage, we're joined now by Dr. Han Baltusson, Senior Lecturer in Classics at the University of Adelaide. So why does he think that Aristotle matters so much?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, Alan, but the most important one, I think, is to just start out with knowing that he was a great scientist and probably one of the first great scientists, and that from that kind of core of his research, he developed his philosophical ideas. And so the philosophical strands of his thinking are very much characterized by a hugely systematic way of thinking, his ambition to be very comprehensive and therefore to cover almost every branch of knowledge that was known then and develop others and new areas as well.
I mean no disrespect to either of them, but I tend to think of Plato as a bit of a poet and Aristotle as a bit of a bureaucrat, just sort of making sure that everything's in the right folder. Is that unfair?
Well, I would think so, but I can see your thinking about that because Plato has been called the most unsystematic of creators, and that means that he was really a very much a pioneer in that sense, and his kind of literary skills on top of all that makes the kind of deep thinking that he does also very attractive. The unfortunate thing about Aristotle's work and transmission of his work is, of course, that we only have the more scholarly and internal works, so-called esoteric writings, which make reading him very difficult. It's a densely kind of constructed prose, and his thinking sort of moves beyond in certain areas what Plato had said. So there is certainly a big difference in how creative and how attractive both were. But I do think that Aristotle's got a lot of creative force in his thinking, so we shouldn't underestimate that.
You said that he was respected in his day or immediately after his day as a great scientist. Obviously, that's a modern term, but was it his empirical work? I mean, he was very, very good at marine life. He was a strong observer of that. Was it this sort of empirical work that captured people's attention more than the sort of thing that we're interested in now, which tend to be the metaphysics and the morals?
Well, it depends a little bit on what you think the audience might be for certain areas. I do think that the works that have been lost were well known for their graceful style, and so Aristotle was certainly somebody who was attractive to a broader audience. But from the work that we do have, we can see that it was probably his natural philosophy as well as the metaphysics that were quite important to his successors. And in addition to that, of course, the way in which he systematized a lot of the ideas about ethics, which was very closely connected to politics in his view, were also studied to some extent. But I don't think that it made such an impact. It is very difficult to trace a lot of these different areas of his work, really. And we're going to have, you know, perhaps a bit more to say about that, but there's a problem there.
If people were reading his metaphysics, what was he offering them there in terms of metaphysics, which really is about, I suppose, what the universe contains on a theoretical level and how it all holds together? What did he have to tell them there?
Well, Aristotle did, of course, learn a lot from Plato in thinking about what is not visible to us but has still got to be there in order to explain the patterns that you can see in the world. So he started talking about matter and form and distinguishing between what is a particular thing made up of. And so his idea was that form was far more important because that determined identity of objects and individuals. And there is something there that is a spin-off from what Plato's thinking. It's just that they differ in the way in which this is all driven. So the form is, for Aristotle, in the thing, and for Plato, it's somewhere outside. So that was the big easy breakdown, perhaps. It's a bit of a crude summary, but that's how Aristotle saw things. It's about what you can't see that has to be there. So to construct some kind of thing that goes beyond physics, as the literal term means, your metaphysics, in order to explain what's going on in the world.
But it's a very different world for him to Plato's world. For Plato, there are chairs, and chairs have the form of a chair, but there is, as it were, a heavenly ideal form of a chair somewhere, of which all these individual chairs are inadequate versions.
Yes, definitely. So Plato sort of plays down the importance of our immediate sensory world and thinks that the only way we can explain that we have abstract notions of the objects that we see, that somehow if chairs look different in color or in shape, there must be an essential thing that makes us think about it as a chair, and that he would then hypothesize as being outside of this world, and therefore this world is far less important than the one that drives this world and informs it for what it is.
So if Aristotle's turning his attention to furniture, he is not assuming that there is some form of a chair which lies beyond the individual chairs that the world contains.
No, he thinks it's the carpenter who has a sense of what a chair should be like, which is based on a form of expertise, a notion of how you make things, how they are functional, that will create that particular object. And, he works from a form that is in some sense perhaps ideal, but it will be somehow created in the material, like with wood, because he has that kind of skill.
So I somewhat unfairly compared Aristotle to a bureaucrat, But there's a poem by W.B. Yeats in which he mentions Plato and Aristotle, and in comparison with Plato, he refers to solider Aristotle. And there is a sort of solidity to this vision of the universe, almost a sort of an earthbound quality to it.
Yes, yes, I would agree with that. I mean, Aristotle is just... I do think that it's not just a biologist and what we would call a scientist, somebody who is really interested in observation, in looking really closely at things around him, and then trying to find causes and explanations which are within nature and within the things. But it is certainly a very important factor in the way that he works. And therefore, as you say, you come to see him as somebody who is more... maybe down to earth, if you like. And if one would, you know, if we just had more of his works that would have been written in this beautiful flowing style that Cicero describes to us, we would be, you know, sort of in a better position to compare Plato and Aristotle on that particular aspect as well.
And Cicero, the Roman writer, he says this, does he, because he has access to works which are no longer available to us?
To some extent, yes. I mean, the interesting thing is about that is that this is the question of the transmission of Aristotle, and there is this very fascinating story which talks about the works being somehow taken away out of Athens and somehow hidden in a ditch by a man called Neleus. And there's a lot of ink been spilt about that story, and we can't quite decide whether it's true or not. But it's an intriguing story because it is trying to explain why there is so little interaction with the works of Aristotle, not only among his successors, but also among some of the other philosophical schools which start to arise, like the Stoics. And there's been a lot of research into that. I think, well, we don't see clearly how people are responding to Aristotle, and you would have expected that in a way. And so it seems that we always have to work from arguments from silence and saying, well, there's very little there that is concretely Aristotelian or a response to Aristotle. Now, Cicero must have had access to some works that were re-emerging in the first century BC, so roughly 200 years after Aristotle died. And there's a very important moment late in the first century where some kind of edition was created. And so people have been speculating about that in order to explain why there was this revival of study of Aristotle's work. So the first 150 years we have successes, and they're not very impressive, which I think is in a way sort of a judgment of hindsight that is not quite fair. And, you know, we're not going to say that all the physicists after Einstein are not as good as Einstein, because it's one of a kind, so if you come after, it's good enough to understand what he's doing and try to develop details, and that's what they did.
You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone on ABC RN. Dr. Han Baltussen from the University of Adelaide is speaking with the late Alan Saunders. This program on the legacy of Aristotle was first broadcast in 2009. They now go on to look at the development of Aristotle's thought after his death and who was working on it. The first person they turn to is Theophrastus, who was a student of Aristotle's and had a personal relationship with him.
He is really quite impressive in his own right, in the same sense as I sort of hinted at earlier, that he has got the breadth of knowledge to cover a lot of what Aristotle covered as well. But of course, Aristotle's already there. So what he does in his work, he trades on the presence of these works and starts to find out whether there is a full systematic coherence to the work and whether there are empirical data that could be improving on that or could be correcting even some of the views that Aristotle put forward. Because while Plato was called this unsystematic creator, people sometimes have referred to Aristotle as this most inconclusive systematizer, in the sense that he had this broad view of the world, tried to explain much of almost everything, but couldn't really finish off all the things that he'd been doing, because the breadth of his research and knowledge is just astounding. So Theophrastus picks up on that and does a pretty good job in continuing and trying to improve some of the works.
Eudemus of Rhodes was Theophrastus's rival, really, for the role of successor Aristotle's successor at the Lyceum, which was the school he founded, but he was also Aristotle's first editor, wasn't he?
Yes, he did some work on some of the ethical writings, and he was really a strong rival for succession. And it's perhaps an interesting question of what if he had been the scholarch instead of Theophrastus. But the anecdote goes that Aristotle on his deathbed said, well, the Lesbian wine is a bit sweeter than the Rhodian wine. And so in this kind of symbolic way, he sort of chose Theophrastus over Eudemus. And it is said that Eudemus then sort of left Athens and went back to Rhodes to maintain his own kind of teaching environment, maybe a school, because Rhodes remains quite important in the Aristotelian tradition.
We were talking about the revival of interest in Aristotle about 200 years after his death, but something that happened in that intervening period is the rise of the Hellenistic philosophers, the Skeptics, the Stoics, the Epicureans. How did this affect interest in Aristotle?
There is a sense, although as I said, it's very difficult to determine exactly on the basis of any evidence, but there is a sense that there was some interaction between these schools of thought because they were close to each other. I mean, Athens wasn't that big, and they must have known about each other. And it is clear that some of the discussions that were going on, especially in natural philosophy, were connected to Aristotelian ideas. I mean, Theophrastus had some quarrel with Zeno about the eternity of the world, for instance, one of the bigger questions of natural philosophy. But it seems that the Hellenistic world was much more in need of having some good ethical guidance, a moral code. And I think that the Stoics really managed much better in offering a moral code, which was, in their view, closely connected to some knowledge about the natural world, because they were very much keen on connecting up all these different areas, the three most important being logic, natural philosophy, and ethics. And I think they had just had more to offer in a world which had become quite turbulent, because, of course, when Alexander the Great died, about 1 year after Aristotle, the big Alexandrian Empire collapsed, as it were, and was divided up into all kinds of smaller kingdoms. And I think that some of that social disorder had an influence on the preference and the prevalence of moral thinking over natural philosophy.
But it's not as though Aristotle was not a moral thinker. He wrote the Nicomachean Ethics, which is normally regarded as one of the great works of moral philosophy in history.
Oh, absolutely. But I think there we come to the problem of the availability of the works. And although we have not enough evidence to make sort of very pertinent statements about it, it seems as if the immediate successors were not very much engaged with it, nor some of the other schools around them. And the suspicion is that it might have been the case that for some time the works were not readily available. Although the story, as I said earlier, that told us about it being taken away to Asia Minor does not preclude there being other copies around. It's just one possible explanation to actually say, well, the emphasis didn't seem to be very much on ethics except internal to the school.
Now, as you say, there's a revival in interest in Aristotle. Once we come to, say, the beginning of the Christian era, what is Aristotle's status?
We have got some information on the broader attitude of Christian authors towards Greek philosophy, and they are somewhat torn. The first authors in the Christian tradition from the second century onwards, we see that they are interested in some of the argumentative aspects of what Greek philosophy can offer in order to defend their own faith.
So that would be Aristotle's logic, for example.
Yes, some of his logic. Because if one work stands out in the first century BC and AD, and the way that we know of some of the sort of the sparse evidence we have, is that they were very interested in the logic, especially what we now call the categories categories. So the categories is a work that looks at terms, if you like. I mean, there's a debate, even antiquity, about whether it's about terms or the things that are referred to by these terms. But apart from that, they were very interested in that. And so, because a lot of the early Christian fathers are part of the Greek world that we find even under the Roman Empire and are educated within the Greek system, much of what they read comes still out of the pagan tradition. And there's a big debate, obviously, in how much you are supposed to be reading of that stuff if you are on the other side of the fence in terms of beliefs and religion. And so they have a very kind of torn view about retaining one bit and rejecting others. And so logic seems to sort of get away with it because it's not specifically related to questions of religion as such. And so it's rather, you know, neutral in theological terms. And they use it to good effect to actually argue in favor of things like the existence of God and the importance of Christian religion.
In the Middle Ages, Aristotle was known as the philosopher. You didn't have to name him. You could just say, the philosopher says this, or in the opinion of the philosopher. When does he acquire this status?
It's not an easy question, but I think that it is important to think of the way in which his work became translated into Latin at some point. And I think that that's especially true with the work of Boethius, who was setting himself the task of trying to translate all of the logical works or everything to do with reasoning as such. He just didn't manage to finish that. But I think the penetration into the Latin West, slowly though, because a lot of the works didn't really reach the West until much later, have something to do with that. But I think the title of the philosopher is partly to do with the fact that a form of canonization was unavoidable, especially in the 2nd century AD when the professor of Aristotelian philosophy in Athens, Alexander Aphrodisias, started to write these elaborate commentaries in his teaching. He would then try to explain Aristotle to his pupils, and he wrote up much of those explanations. And they are vast, detailed, and very much helpful commentaries that explain Aristotle to anyone who wants to know about him. And he was a peripatetic in his thinking, although he did criticize Aristotle at some point. So if you have somebody who advocates Aristotelianism in a way that is based directly on Aristotle's works, except, you know, because that had happened before, there were parallel stories about Aristotle which would be just based on summaries, then you have a much better chance of getting that particular authority across of the philosopher.
I mean, this is an impossible question, but is it possible to imagine Western philosophy without Aristotle and his heritage?
Eventually, I don't think so, because of the impact that his works had. We're very lucky that much of it survived in the East and then in the 15th century came across to the West. I mean, some of it came a little bit earlier because, of course, we owe a lot to the Arabic philosophers in the 9th century who almost obliterated most of his followers because they were just interested in Aristotle, people like Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi. So I'm not an expert on that area, but they are crucial in the way in which Aristotle already came to the West through Spain much earlier. But with the fall of Constantinople in the 15th century, of course, that was a major influx. And people were so blown away by that kind of huge systematic approach to the world where there was so much that was being explained which hadn't been done, at least not known to the West, that there is hardly a possible way of thinking about the Western canon without Aristotle.
Dr. Han Balthusan, Senior Lecturer in Classics at the University of Adelaide, was speaking there with the late Alan Saunders. And that was part three of the series on Greek philosophy, which we're broadcasting to celebrate the work of Alan since his passing on June the 15th. It originally went to air on the Philosopher's Zone in 2009. The show was produced by Kyla Slaven with sound engineer Charlie McCune. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Next week, in part four of the series, more about Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, and what was known as the translation movement, centred on the city of Baghdad, and what happened to the work of Aristotle there. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Bye for now.